فیلم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه و jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
این منظومه شمسی که ما در یک کره.
How orderly are these galaxy and the world in which we live? All the discoveries that were made during the history by astronomers and astrologists have been based on the order of the celestial bodies and planets. If it was not so, then they could not find such an order and symmetry in their calculations. Now, the interesting point is that if there is a mistake or problem in calculations, it is with the sciences and their interpretations and not the systematic and orderly manner of the creation by Allah. In other words, solar system is working based on the order that was destined for it by Allah.
الان این چیزهایی که میفرستند به کرات دیگه تمام اینا بر اساس همون
This point is completely witnessed in the discoveries of spaceships to the other planets too. The spaceships are able to reach their destinations only if they are in harmony with order of the solar system and the other planets. In fact, there is a specific calculation in their works, but their calculations adjust the higher calculations that were made by Allah in the whole solar system. These are all the signs of the wisdom of Allah in His creation of the galaxy. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we look into India's military presence in the Maldives. And we will explore the future of India's automobile industry.
With its thousands of islands stretching hundreds of kilometers into the Indian Ocean and straddling crucial sea lanes through which 40% of the world's fuel shipments flow, Maldives has always been a stage for strategic wrestling between both New Delhi and Beijing. For most of its independent history, since 1965, the South Asian archipelagic country has generally enjoyed excellent relations with India, while keeping communication channels open with China as both try to turn their tide in their direction in the Indian Ocean region.
The rapidly shifting geopolitical climate of the Indian Ocean is aggravated by Sino-Indian competition for influence in the Maldives. The island nation needs to upgrade its military capabilities through the acquisition of modern armaments, but apparently lack resources. Situated at the epicenter of a game between China and India for dominance of the Indian Ocean, it has to make the best use of its strategic geopolitical leverage. India has a long-standing relationship with neighboring the Maldives, but recently it is under threat amid a surge in anti-Indian sentiment. Maldivians have taken to social media and hit the streets to protest against India's military presence in their island nation, calling for Indian troops' unconditional and immediate departure. They describe it as a possible threat to their national sovereignty, with conspiracy theories circulating that the presence is a prelude to Indian annexation of Maldivian territory. Further narrowing India's earlier edge, China has made new inroads into the country via funding big infrastructure projects, including major island connecting bridges. Massive constructions in the island of Feidu Finolu, leased until 2016 by Beijing from the Maldivian government for $4 million, have also created rumors that China is establishing a military base there.
Widely perceived as pro-Indian, President Ibrahim Mohamed Soleh was elected with nearly 60% of the votes in 2018. Soleh beat out Abdullah Yameen Abdul Gayoom, who had prioritized closer ties with China. However, there is still speculation that Soleh's government is quietly trying to rebuild ties to China to financially assist its COVID-devastated economy.
India considers the countries in the Indian Ocean, including the Maldives, as part of its sphere of influence. To maintain a geopolitical balance, India has permanently stationed two helicopters and a Dornier surveillance aircraft in the Maldives under a long-standing bilateral defense pact. India has also helped establish a constellation of coastal radars aligned with its own grid on all 26 Maldivian atolls to monitor approaching sea vessels and aircraft. But the Indian reconnaissance aircraft and choppers deployed, along with the military personnel who operate them, is increasingly viewed with suspicion in the Maldives. Maldivians say no external power is allowed to have forces or facilities at any military base across the country's strategically located atolls following the withdrawal of British troops in 1976. Nothing that only India continues to have a boots-on-the-ground presence. As a goodwill gesture to ease tensions, the Indian Navy has recently said that it had provided the Maldives National Defence Force with a Dornier aircraft as per an intergovernmental agreement. The aircraft will reportedly be based in the northern Maldivian base of Hani Madu and nominally be operated, commanded and controlled by the Maldivian military, with the Indian government bearing the aircraft's operating costs.
Now, for some insight, we are joined by Mr. Muad Mohamed Zaki, who is a senior member of Maldivian Democratic Party while in exile. He's a former political prisoner and currently a political activist and not part of any political party. Mr. Zaki, welcome to the subcontinent. So, what is India's strategy to counter China's influence in Maldives?
Well, before the 2018 presidential elections, some of the leaders of the Maldivian Democratic Party, who are very close with President Modi, had actually already started various online campaigns, basically targeting Chinese investments negatively. This has actually created fear and suspicion in Chinese investments in the country. That was followed by the Indian government's full backing of the Maldivian Democratic Party, is led coalition in the Maldives to run against the pro-China President Yameen, Yameen's government. And after that, India has seen, and India is seen also to be received the backing of Saudi Arabia and the United States in plans for the Maldives. From the time the opposition won the elections, the Indian military has actually increased its presence in the country from north to south drastically. So this is a concern for a country like Maldives, because we are a 100% Muslim country. And we also know the ongoing Kashmiri occupation by India. So this has caused a lot of fear in the country on India's ambitions in the country.
Okay, and what is China's approach to increase its influence in Maldives?
I do not think that China needs to do much other than to sit and watch. All they need to do is to wait and see, because no matter how much loans that India gives the government, the reality of the situation is that in times like COVID-19, no matter how much foreign loans are injected into the economy at the moment to keep it afloat, it is just a short-term solution. At the moment, the government does not seem to have any long-term solutions. The Indian government has taken full control of full advantage of our country's politicians' lack of understanding on international politics and military strategy. We must remind ourselves that the Maldives had only become a multi-party system in 2008, which is not long ago. Therefore, our politicians have not had the time to understand the big political backdoor games that international politics has in play. Nevertheless, China knows very well that if everything else fails, be it this government or the next government, the Maldives will go back to China for help, because China has proven that when it comes to development, it does carry through, even if there are questions to be asked on specific investments.
All right, Mr. Zaki, what is the result of this rivalry for people of the Maldives?
The supporters from both sides of politics has seen that this foreign interference in our country's domestic affairs has wasted a lot of our government's time that could have been actually spent better in planning for the COVID-19 impact on our economy. Supporters of the ruling coalition parties has also been voicing their concern over India's growing military activities in the country and the worsening economic situation. However, their leaders have not given actually much satisfactory answers to the party members. I think this is one of the reasons why the Election Commission had recently announced that the party membership of the ruling coalition party, Maldivian Democratic Party, has been decreasing, while the opposition party's party membership has actually been increasing. I think the Indian government seems to be the only one benefiting from this. They are effectively now controlling our foreign policy as well. At the OIC or any other international platforms, the Maldives seem to be busy defending India instead of finding much-needed assistance for Maldivian families, small businesses, homeowners and renters. Everyone is suffering in the Maldives.
Mr. Zaki, please, let's just take a look at how the global media has covered this situation, and then we can continue.
India has taken a lead over China in their contest for influence in the Maldives. New Delhi would fund the implementation of the Greater Malé Connectivity Project through a $100 million grant and a $400 million line of credit. The project is a 6.7-kilometer long bridge and causeway link that will connect the Maldivian capital Malé with the neighboring islands of Vilengili, Gulifao, and Thilafushi. It also includes the building of a port at Gulifahu and an industrial zone in Thilafushi.
Unlike a similar initiative 7 years ago, the new framework for cooperation between the US and Maldivian Departments of Defense went through without objection from India, a leading player in the latest version of the South Asian Great Game in which China, Japan, and the US are contesting for influence. India is also part of Quad, an alliance that includes Australia, Japan, and the US. They have held security dialogues and military exercises spanning the Pacific and Indian Ocean.
All right, thank you for staying with us. Now, do you think the people or government of Maldives favor one over the other?
I do not think the Maldives government or the people really favor one over another. The Maldivians are loving people. We love people from all countries and religions. We want to get along with all countries except for apartheid Israel. We wish India and China both invest in our countries together. There are plenty of space for both to actually invest in where we all can benefit together. However, India bringing in their military instead of infrastructure projects, then it's not good for the government or the people or the country. The current situation is that once we had let the Trojan horse into the country, we are now stuck with them. There is no easy solution to the current situation. That's the scary part. Let's say in the future, if the government asks the Indian military to leave the country, will they leave? I don't think so.
Mr. Zaki, thank you so much for being on our show. Let's see how people on social media see this situation.
Using the hashtag India Out, Muson Baharu believes the presence of the Indian military in Maldives is unconstitutional and completely illegitimate. Ahmed Azan suggests that people need to show their aversion to the Indian military presence in the country. And regarding the tweet of Hassan Ali, although he has a positive view of India and its people, he opposes any foreign military presence in Maldives and considers it a violation to the country's sovereignty.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Driving is not for the faint of heart in India, whose streets are perhaps the most dangerous ones in the world. Indian traffic drives on the left, but most of its drivers are in the middle of the road paying little heed to the rules and doing anything they can to avoid queuing. According to a 2007 report, more than 130,000 people die on the roads of India. India needs to revamp its transportation and design new traffic management systems. But how?
The future of the automobile industry will probably be either electric or hybrid. Future cars will either do all the driving or the human at the helm can steer the wheel sometimes to manipulate a decision. For a country with crazy streets, air pollution, and an enormously big market, it can also have unexpected social and political as well as economic consequences. Electric cars have zero emissions and self-driving cars reduce the casualties tremendously, but they are expensive and require supporting infrastructure. Creating or importing infrastructure mean investment by foreign firms. This may disrupt the indigenous car manufacturing industry and even increase dependency on US technology. The Indian automobile market is so gigantic and fast flourishing that almost everybody wants to have a bit of it. Washington is more than eager to invest in the country's car market, but some believe it only aims to decrease and counter China's share in the market as part of its trade war with China. Recent trends suggest a rise in the interest among the common masses for electric cars. With such prospects for profit, who will manage to help India switch over from conventional petrol diesel-powered cars to electric or hybrid self-driving vehicles?
Business magnate and industrial designer Elon Musk has recently said that the United States electric vehicle and clean energy company Tesla will make its entry into India in 2021. It can simply be a propaganda gimmick, as it has happened before. In 2016, Musk said that the company would launch the Tesla 3 model in India with a countrywide supercharger network. However, this has not happened. In 2018, Musk said he had plans to begin Tesla operations in India in 2019, but this too did not come to fruition.
Raucous and unruly traffic isn't the only problem in the Indian streets. In its road for the adoption of electric vehicles or self-driving cars, India faces numerous environmental, economic, and social challenges. In addition to measures aimed at elevating mundane issues such as the absence of road signs, dangerous potholes, and poorly maintained footpaths, India has to build nationwide charging infrastructure. It needs high-tech battery production lines, and it must consider the supply-demand gap as well as creating a closed loop. Shortage of homegrown battery cells in India will increase the dependency on imports from Japan, China, Korea, and Europe, as well as the US. Hence, the Indian government needs to incentivize indigenous manufacturers towards technologies better suited for the country's market, such as aluminium fuel cells. The establishment of a robust supply chain is also crucial for automakers to make the shift feasible. Moreover, recycling stations must be set up to recover the metals from batteries to create the closed loop required for the transition to electric cars to be an environmentally sound decision. India wants over one-third of vehicles electric by 2030, but the goal seems fantastically out of reach unless it introduces more incentives, tax cuts, or rebates that benefit all stakeholders in the process.
To learn more about this, we now have with us Mr. Paranjoy Guha Thakurta, who's an Indian author, journalist, and commentator on economic and political affairs. Mr. Thakurta, welcome to the show. So, how successful do you see the auto industry in India?
Thank you for inviting me to your program, and I must say that the auto industry is in a very, very bad shape at present. I think never in the history of India's automobile industry has the situation been as bad as it has present. For the first time since the automobile industry was set up many, many decades ago, in the month of April 2020, there were no sales, zero sales of any kind of automobile, from heavy vehicles, that is trucks and lorries, to personalized vehicles, passenger cars, to buses, to even two-wheelers, motorcycles and mopeds and scooters. This has never happened before. This is the first time it's happened. And on top of it, you have the heavy vehicles, like the commercial vehicles, the trucks and the lorries and the buses, their sales have come down much more than the sales of two-wheelers like scooters and motorcycles and mopeds. And it is not just a demand recession which is affecting India's automotive industry, but also the switch over to new emission norms. In a sense, the industry has gone back to where it was 4 or 5 years ago. And these are the figures. If you go to the official industry association, the Society of Indian Automobile Manufacturers, you will see the numbers are there for you to check yourself. On top of all that, the insurance numbers the insurance payments have gone up, the prices of the vehicles have gone up, and banks have tightened the norms on which they give loans to individuals to buy the vehicles, or even to not just individuals, to organizations and corporate entities. So a combination of all these factors, demand recession, a new switch, emission norms, insurance policies, the premium has gone up, increase in prices, all of this has resulted in the Indian automobile industry going through a huge crisis. I would say the biggest ever crisis in the history of India's automotive industry.
Mr. Thakur, before moving ahead with the next questions, let's see the media views regarding this problem.
To make an autonomous car safe, developers need to make it as smart as humans, at least in certain respects. To negotiate the unruly Delhi traffic, driverless cars need a whole different level of smarts. In Western cities, traffic rules are followed, signs are obeyed, and the right of way is given, not taken. It's anything but so in Delhi and countless other Indian cities. In a country like India with a little over 1.3 billion people, any policy decision that may impact jobs appears justifiable at first blush. Why then is India insistent on introducing electric vehicles that may help unclog the air to some extent but destroy many jobs in the traditional auto sector? The most challenging part in electric vehicle manufacturing is producing lithium-ion batteries. Therefore, the government has to play an essential role in it. Only then the final price of EV will be decreased. According to a report, the price of lithium-ion battery can reduce by up to 80%. That only requires a larger volume of production. If government is unable to achieve significant battery clusters, India's plan to transition to EVs will never be fulfilled.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Thakurta. So, how much do you think politics affects this industry?
I think politics has not got that much of an impact. It is more the economic situation, the slowdown in the economy, the recession, the demand recession that is in the economy. Now, if you look at up to the end of March of 2020, for the last 2 years, we are seeing India's gross domestic product or GDP, the rate of growth has been constantly slowing down. Then you had the pandemic, and on top of that, you had the economic lockdown, which was a very, very harsh lockdown, which started from the midnight of the 24th of March, 2020. So we've seen a huge migration of people, internal migration within India. So all of these factors, the combination of all these factors and the economic recession has resulted in the India's automobile industry being in the state that it is. Now, yes, of course, everything is impacted by politics. You could argue if the government of India headed by Mr. Narendra Modi, which is who is the leader of the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is a right-wing Hindu nationalist political party. If the lockdown was less harsh, then maybe the recession and the demand recession would have impacted the industry less. But that's now a thing of the past. Automobile sales had been going down for some time, even before the pandemic and the lockdown. And the pandemic and the lockdown has resulted in things worsening very, very much, very, very badly. And as I mentioned right at the beginning, for the first time in the history of India's automobile industry, in August 2020, there were no sales, zero sales.
Mr. Thakurta, thank you so much for being with us on our show. It was very nice having you here. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
The official Twitter account of Mint refers to Nitin Gadkari, the road transport minister, that the government plans to make India an automobile manufacturing hub in the next 5 years. Also, these two tweets of the Press Information Bureau contain more details about the minister's words and the government's plan in the field of electric vehicles, taking steps in reducing the air pollution and so on.
And that was our episode covering the rift in Maldives between India and China and the Indian automobile industry. We'll meet next week.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It seems that there's finally a light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the development and administration of a vaccine against the COVID-19 virus, with multiple research centres finally in the latter stages of producing a viable and effective vaccine against the virus. However, while so close to the end, is the decision by the British to roll out the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine a little too soon. Already the British and the US have been arguing about the timing of the promise by the British government to start inoculating the most vulnerable groups of people in the UK by as early as this coming Monday, with the US criticising the British either due to the early release of a yet untested product, or maybe through jealousy of being pipped to the post by the Brits, with the UK having the worst rates in Europe. With already 60,000 people dead from the virus, the US is also in a difficult situation, with around 1,500 people dying each day, and already 276,000 people having succumbed to the coronavirus in America. Embarrassing figures for the outgoing president of the United States, who would have no doubt enjoyed being the first to distribute the vaccine. So why then are the British and Americans fighting over the issue? With the British choosing to start with the order of 40 million Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines, it seems odd that they have chosen a vaccine developed outside of the UK. Yet when one examines the effectiveness of the vaccines available, the British version, developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, is only around 62% effective. Hence maybe why the British have rushed ahead with the German-US version, quicker than the Americans and the Germans themselves. So could the tension then come from the attitude of the British when it comes to wanting to get the vaccine out as quickly as possible, rushing it through the regulators at such a pace? British Education Minister Gavin Williamson clearly flared tempers with his attitude towards the US and the EU when he stated that British regulators were obviously better, and then going one step further, saying the whole of the UK was better than the US and the EU. Clearly a diplomatic flop by publicly stating such words. What now remains to be seen is A, just how realistic the monumental task of distributing a vaccine that needs to be kept at minus 70 degrees will be, and B, will the US show any sympathy towards the UK should the process fail, and as Britain comes crashing out of the EU, looking at the US for a future trade deal. Britain is against the ropes when it comes to the Brexit negotiations with the EU. However, the announcement that the British will have the vaccine out on Monday is something that the British negotiating team will secretly be proud of as talks reach a stalemate in London. But the EU, with all its red tape, bureaucracy and processes, has yet to fully approve any developed vaccine so far and has taken the opportunity to criticise the UK for a hasty decision when it comes to announcing the vaccine will be available to various groups within Britain. Until the European Medicines Agency approves a vaccine, the rest of the continent will have to remain patient. However, there are arguments that the EMA is more rigorous than the British, leading the Germans to label the move by the British as problematic. But the UK may have one valid point when it comes to the rollout. If the vaccine is truly over 95% effective and it can save lives, then what's wrong with the British taking such a step? With the British finding themselves stuck in a desperate situation when it comes to agreeing a deal with the EU in the post-Brexit era, and time fast running out before the deadline approaches to switch to WTO rules, could then the decision by the British to start distribution be a final dig at the EU and prove that by no longer being part of the bloc, it can take such decisions without fallout that would have emerged from Brussels should they still have been members? But the truth of the matter is simple. This is one of the world's worst cases of a global pandemic, at least in modern times, and the economic impact, as well as the devastating cost of life, has left a scar and legacy that will never be forgotten. So whether it be Pfizer-BioNTech, AstraZeneca, Moderna, or Gamaleya, and whether it's the UK, the US, or the EU, or in fact any other country that starts the vaccine first, at the end of the day, this is a humanitarian issue, and when the time comes, the whole world will need the doses eventually.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have managed to flee Myanmar's northwestern state of Rakhine, where they repeatedly came under attack by the army and extremist Buddhists. Many of these refugees have come to Bangladesh over the past years. They have largely been camped in the southern district of Cox's Bazar in overcrowded camps and in squalid conditions. This week, Bangladeshi authorities began moving Rohingya families from the camps near the Myanmar border without their consent. Bangladeshi police escort the refugees in buses to a port and then to this island. Basan Char is their destination, a flood-prone island vulnerable to frequent cyclones. The remote island, the Bay of Bengal, emerged from the sea 20 years ago. The government of Bangladesh says it has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on a small city there with mosques and red-roofed apartment blocks. It says the relocation will ease chronic overcrowding in camps at Cox's Bazar. But the refugees are unwilling to set foot on the remote island. There are many concerns about the conditions of the brand new settlement. For instance, distance from the mainland will make it very difficult to reach the refugees in emergencies. Meanwhile, hundreds of Rohingya who were sent to the island in April after being picked up at sea don't want to remain there. They have accused settlement guards of sexual assault. Bangladeshi authorities have not allowed the United Nations or rights groups to monitor their relocation.
It really raises the question, what is Bangladesh hiding if, you know, it has gone to such controversial length to decline offer, consistently offered by the United Nations agencies and UN itself, to do basic safety assessment of the island.
Rights groups want Bangladesh to halt the controversial move immediately. Rohingya Muslims are recognized by the UN as the world's worst persecuted minority group. In January, the United Nations highest court ordered Buddhist majority Myanmar to prevent genocidal violence against its Rohingya Muslim minority and preserve evidence of past attacks. The International Court of Justice instructed the Asian country to respect the requirements of the 1948 Genocide Convention. The ICJ warned that nearly 600,000 Rohingya Muslims who are still in Myanmar are, quote, extremely vulnerable to violence at the hands of the military. But since the ICJ ruling, little has really changed them. Human rights lawyers and activists said recently that Myanmar is continuing to commit genocide against Rohingya Muslims in violation of orders by the UN's top court. The ongoing crisis has left the international reputation of Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who is a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, in tatters. Suu Kyi has defended the actions of the army and is unwilling to change her stance. Many rights groups and Rohingya activists have been demanding that she be stripped of her Nobel Peace Prize. But so far, no meaningful action has been taken against her or the military.
Myanmar government has not really been put under any type of concerted pressure, you know, not by the United States, not by the European Union, not by British government, not certainly by China or India or Japan.
Powerful states have considerable trade ties with Myanmar. They can easily use their economic leverage to force change in Myanmar's behavior, but they have chosen not to exert pressure on the country over the plight of the minority group.
It seems that even when Britain is down on its knees, it receives yet another kick in the teeth to make sure it won't get up again. The acclaimed and once respected British retail industry has seen two of its super heavyweights each receive a knockout blow to go with the rest of the nation, as both have collapsed dramatically within a day of each other. After 242 years of trading on the British High Street, what started off as a single store in London, well-known brand Debenhams has collapsed, putting at risk thousands of jobs and seeing 124 stores set to close for good, leaving a significant gap in the retail areas of the UK. Joining Debenhams and collapsing just a day before is the Arcadia Group, which owns the likes of Topshop, Burton, Dorothy Perkins and Evans, and will see 13,000 employees looking for work as Christmas approaches and a grim year comes to an end.
What all retailers need to understand, and some do it better than others, is that we need to have a reason to visit their stores. So I think as one of the lessons from this, although sadly, yeah, for the workforce at Arcadia, that might not apply so much, but for the industry, one of the lessons is that your store estate has got to be great. It's got to inspire, it's got to excite, and it's got to draw people in.
Between Debenhams and Arcadia, some 25,000 people will now join the unemployment figures that Britain is already suffering with. And alarmingly, with the majority of staff in the retail sector fairly unskilled, the prospects of a new job are far from a reality. Yet it's not just the retail sector that has suffered in Britain, with many other industries and big names collapsing in 2020, in part due to the COVID-19 virus, but also thanks to the disastrous handling of Brexit, which has seen many low-skilled workers flee the UK into richer European markets, leaving a gap in the labour market that's simply not being filled by the British. What now remains to be seen is whether the introduction of the upcoming vaccine created by Pfizer and BioNTech, which has just been approved by the British government, will come in time to save the other few remaining retail outlets that are hanging on by a thread as Brexit fast approaches, the COVID-19 pandemic peaks at its second wave, and the people and institutions of Britain are left on a knife edge as uncertainty reigns over the country. The next 36 hours will be crucial as Michel Barnier continues to work around the clock to put pressure on the British negotiating team to accept the terms and conditions being imposed by the EU. With Barnier in constant liaison with the 27 remaining EU states as to the progress of the talks, of which he holds the power of attorney on behalf of the EU. Yet in spite of multiple rounds of talks, Barnier remains far from optimistic that a deal can be done and has warned the EU nations to face the very real prospect that Britain will leave the EU with no deal, leaving trade and commerce to continue under WTO rules, which will no doubt be far more painful for Britain than it will for the EU. Many EU nations have stated that they support Barnier and are insisting that he remain tough to the end, suggesting that under no circumstances should he compromise with the British to allow a deal to go through, unless it fully benefits the EU, with France leading the resistance and seeing backing from many other European superpowers.
Und ich wünsche Michel Barnier und gegebenenfalls auch Ursula von der Leyen viel Kraft und viel Geschick für die letzten Verhandlungsschritte. Wir brauchen aber auch kein Abkommen um jeden Preis. Das haben wir deutlich gemacht. Wir wollen eins, aber wir werden sonst auch Maßnahmen ergreifen, die notwendig sind. Auf jeden Fall liegt ein Abkommen im Interesse aller.
So clear is the obvious lack of leadership displayed by the British negotiating team and the Conservative government of Boris Johnson, who so eagerly fought for Brexit, that the people of Britain are also waking up to the reality of the impact of Brexit, such as the collapse of the British retail industry, with many in Britain now showing signs that they're worried about what the future may hold for the tiny island nation. What is guaranteed is that Britain can no longer put all the blame on the COVID-19 virus for its disastrous year, and must now finally acknowledge that without the EU powerhouse to prop it up, Britain is weak and is falling faster than a house of cards. Death to America and Israel, with the Iranian lawmakers chanting condemnation of the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist. The day started with the passing of a draft bill at Iran's parliament. This was the first retaliation by Iran after the assassination of the Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The provisions that were passed, which still need to be approved before turning into law, were the backbone of the JCPOA, hard-fought in negotiations between Iran and the world powers. Some of the provisions that were passed by Iran's parliament include the enrichment of uranium up to 20% level and the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to launch a plant to produce metal uranium in Esfahan. It would also revive heavy water reactor within 2 to 4 months. The number of centrifuges would also increase. This would be a clear blow to the IAEA and the world powers, since Iran has been compliant in working with the organization. But Parliament has also sent a 3-month deadline for it to stop applying additional protocols of the IAEA, a draft bill that will also require the Iranian government to stop any IAEA inspections beyond additional protocol. All of this should sound familiar, since they were part of the JCPOA. But now, Iran is arguing that enough is enough. The JCPOA wasn't even fully operational, and that it had become a tool for the European signatories to apply pressure on Iran, whilst allowing the EU to remain on the fence when it came to treading between Iran and the United States.
Well, ever since the United States, at the behest of Donald Trump, left the JCPOA, and I believe that's about 2.5 years ago, there has been repeated urgings by the European powers that are still in the agreement and the other powers that are still in the agreement beseeching Iran to wait, that they'll do something, they'll take measures to help relieve the problem of the sanctions imposed by the United States. But as far as we can see, very, very little has happened. So it comes to a point where now we have another assassination of a leading scientist, leading official. We have word from Washington that the Trump administration and Trump himself is thinking, can we have a military strike on Iran? Given these circumstances, I don't think that the Iranian government had any choice but to take further action.
When the US pulled out of the JCPOA under the executive order of Donald Trump, the EU stated that they would remain committed to the accord and continue to respect the terms and conditions of the agreement. Yet, the EU have simply used their rhetoric to sit neatly on the fence and neither respect or disregard issues such as trade, sanctions, and diplomacy with Iran. Yet, with Donald Trump still at the helm at the White House, at least until January, the EU must now start to lobby support from President-elect Joe Biden, which is something that should not be too difficult, as Biden himself has stated that he would like to re-enter the JCPOA once he takes office. Yet for Iran, the options that lie ahead are plentiful when it comes to managing how it will emerge from the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and how it plays out its diplomatic options in the future, with the expansion of its peaceful civilian nuclear program being just the first step. But what other options then could Iran also choose?
For one thing, Iran could have the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, inspectors leave. The inspectors, ever since the JCPOA was put into place in 2015, they have over and over and over again stated that Iran is meeting all the conditions of the JCPOA. But why would Iran continue to meet the conditions of the JCPOA when other countries are not? And when their adherence to the conditions of the JCPOA, the Iranian government's adherence to them, has not produced anything that is helpful to Iran. And in fact, the situation has gone downhill.
Does this then mean that the Israeli regime has shot itself in the foot by assassinating Fakhrizadeh Already many nations across the globe have condemned the act, and the consequences now mean that Iran has the upper hand. Should the future lead to the negotiating table, with Iran able to cite the illegal actions of the Israeli regime as a key reason to undermine the Zionist government of Netanyahu and co. For Iran, as a force for peace in the region and the rest of the world, the time has come for it to progress into the future, having defiantly beaten the maximum pressure policy imposed by Trump, and show the world that it's a cooperative partner. Yet should the need arise, it can still continue on its very capable path without relying on any other nation in the process.
In the limelight.
U.S. wage data released recently reveal the continuation of a trend that began at the end of 1970s and which has given the United States of America the dubious distinction of having the worst income inequality among most developed countries. While U.S. income inequality is the worst among most developed nations, its wealth inequality is even more egregious. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading, New U.S. Data Show Income of Top 1/10% Soared 345%, while that of bottom 90% stagnated over past 40 years. Here's the details of this article. U.S. wage data released recently revealed the continuation of a trend that began at the end of 1970s and which has given the United States of America the dubious distinction of having the worst income inequality among most developed nations. The Economic Policy Institute reports that between 1979 and 2019, the top 1% of people in the U.S., whose mean income was nearly $738,000 in 2018, have enjoyed 160% income growth, while wages for the bottom 90% have stagnated, rising just 26% over the same 40-year period. The figures showed massive inequality even among the top 1%, as the highest 1/10%, those making an average of $2.82 million, skyrocketed 345% since 1979. While U.S. income inequality is the worst among most developed nations, its wealth inequality is even more egregious. According to a 2017 report from the Institute for Policy Studies, the three wealthiest Americans at the time, Jeff Bezos, who has since become the world's first multi-centibillionaire, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett, collectively held more wealth than the bottom 50% of the population, or some 160 million people. Experts say it is no accident that the period in which the yawning, ever-growing chasm between rich and poor began coincides with the rise of corporatist and neoliberal economic policies, colloquially dubbed trickle-down economics, implemented by conservative leaders including British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and President Ronald Reagan in the U.S. Thomas Piketty, a French economist whose work focuses on economic inequality and who authored the seminal book Capital, in the 21st century, and the recently published Capital and Ideology says the coronavirus pandemic presents an opportunity for U.S. leaders to finally make a serious attempt to address income disparities. We have to revisit some of our ideologies, some of what we believe is the conventional wisdom at a given point in time, Piketty told Hill TV last week. I think we should use this opportunity to develop more social state, social policies in general, by which I mean a better income support mechanism, safety net, and better access to education. There is nothing natural in the way the economy is organized, Piketty continued. It's all a matter of political choices, of ideology. I think it's important to send a message to working America and to low-wage America that you can have economic justice together with economic prosperity. Piketty implored the incoming administration of Joe Biden to embrace egalitarian economic policies espoused by progressives such as ex-presidential primary rivals Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, including a tax on billionaires, which he said is actually pretty popular if you look at the polls. I think you need to have a more ambitious policy platform of giving a better chance to more disadvantaged socioeconomic groups, Piketty said. We're talking about a higher minimum wage, more investment in public universities, more progressive taxation at the top. I think it will be a big mistake for the Democratic Party leadership to abandon this kind of idea, he added. Standing in stark contrast to what economists like Piketty say must be done to combat inequality, the administration of President Donald Trump, who has boasted of giving billionaires a $1.5 trillion tax break, said this week that it supports Senate Republicans' proposal to freeze the wages of the more than 2 million people who work for the federal government.
IRIB English Radio.